Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, why what a police officer in Toronto didn't do may be important for police officers here. Maybe you've seen the video. The man suspected of killing 10 people and injuring 14 others with his van is in a standoff with a police officer. And here's what happens next. You can hear the suspect there saying, "I have a gun in my pocket," and you can hear the constable saying, "Get down." Toronto Constable Ken Lamb does something unexpected. Even though the suspect is saying he has a gun in his pocket, Lamb pauses and turns, goes back to his car, and turns off the siren. He's de-escalating the situation, even as the suspect is shouting, "Kill me." That suspect is ultimately taken into custody, and the former deputy police chief of Toronto told the New York Times that Constable Lamb was demonstrating the techniques that police officers are trained in. Now, to be clear, Toronto's police force has also had its share of shootings, particularly involving people with mental illness. But perhaps there's something that can be taken away from this incident for American officers. Two guests on what can be learned from this and your thoughts on whether awareness has changed police behavior. If you're in law enforcement, what do you see in that Toronto officer's response? For all of us, do you think public pressure on police departments is changing the way officers behave in use of force situations? I'd like to hear from police officers today, anybody in law enforcement, on what you see in that confrontation in Toronto, and this overall question about whether public pressure on police departments is indeed changing the way officers behave in use of force situations, taking into account what happened in Sacramento, taking into account some of these more recent police shootings, but also the commitment that departments have made to train around this and to change, make some serious changes. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm having a few problems with Twitter today. I'll just let you know it might be a little slow, so please feel free to tweet me. It's at Carrie NPR, and I'll get to as many of the comments when they come up on the Twitter feed. My guest today, Yasmin Kremadine, is Director of Research and Development at Pro Training, and she's with us from Edmonton, Canada. And Yasmin, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
David Thomas joins us. He's Associate Professor of Forensic Psychology at Florida Gulf Coast University and a former Gainesville police officer. And he's with us from Gainesville, Florida. And David, welcome to you. It's really good to talk to you again.
Hi, Carrie. How are you?
I'm doing well. David, I'm curious about whether you've what you've taken away. I know you've seen the video. As you've studied it, what kinds of conclusions are you drawing about what happened?
Well, based on it's interesting that as right after this occurred, my wife and I, we were looking at it on the news and we go, my God, if this was in the States, he probably would have been dead.
Right.
Just because of the movements and what it transpired when he reached behind his back and whipped out whatever he had in his hand. The fact that the officer had the wherewithal, understood that he had control and had the wherewithal to go back and turn off his siren and then start to initiate further dialogue in order to show that he had control, I think shows great restraint and as well as their training program.
Why are you so certain that had this happened in the United States that the suspect would have died from a police officer, potentially the person that was in the standoff with him shooting him?
Well, from a practical standpoint, when I look at the encounter, the officer is in the open. and he has no cover. Mm-hmm. And so when that movement is made, which is legally is known as a furtive movement, that sudden movement kind of puts you in danger, and most officers would not wait to see what was presented.
I see.
And they would shoot.
Yasmin, what did you see in that video, and what does it tell you about your understanding of how police officers are trained in Canada?
I would say this is definitely a high-stress situation, and every encounter does end differently. What I do know to compare Canada to the United States is that in Canada, we have less amount of police organizations. So we have around 235. And I do know that in the United States, there's about 18,000. But with the 235 police services in Canada, I do know that they designate $1 billion that is spent on ongoing training. So every year, officers need to be trained not only in use of force, but in de-escalation and communication techniques. So this ongoing training, I believe, prepares officers. They have this training in the forefront of their mind. They train in de-escalation while training in use of force. And because of that, they're able to use those skills, I guess, hand in hand. Whereas in the United States, there's 18,000 police agencies, the small services, they have limited capacity mm-hmm. and limited training opportunities.
Yasmin, I don't want to act like here that Toronto has this all figured out. As I said, as I was reading the background of some of the shootings that have occurred in Toronto, there have mm-hmm. been deadly confrontations with people with mental illness. And this is something that the Toronto Police Department has had to take seriously. Yes?
That is correct. All police organizations do take it seriously. And I do know that we learn from our mistakes. And Canada is not perfect by far. But again, we learn from our mistakes. We see what we need to do to get our officers to be where they need to be so that both the officer and the people that they're interacting with can stay safe, because that is the ultimate goal. It is officer safety and the safety of those that they are interacting with.
David, as you watch the video, does Constable Lamb's body language, the tone of voice, what he's saying, tell you anything about the power of de-escalation?
It absolutely does. In fact, what it shows me is that he's confident in his skill set. And that is because if you think about use of force, those are perishable skills. If we talk about firearms or hands-on type of stuff, that is absolutely positive. Those are positively perishable skills. But based on his training, I've said this 1,000 times over, he was able to recognize the issue and was able to change his tone in midst of the confrontation, recognizing it for what it was. And that's a very difficult thing for officers to do, because when they look at it, they usually look at it in one way, that it is a flow. And as it's going up that chart, it's very hard to get to the top of where you're ready to use deadly force and then de-escalate back. So whatever they're doing as far as their training goes is something that needs to be looked at.
So I'm struck by the language that you just used. You said it's a flow on a chart, and going up to the top of that chart is something that's hard to, I think you said, assess or predict. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at force, it would start an officer's force. It really would start from the time he or she arrives on the scene. And then ultimately, deadly force would be the last part of that encounter. And so as that force or as that officer perceives the threat, that pushes that pushes you right to the limit, right to the top of where you have the firearm drawn, you're pointed at somebody, and you're giving them verbal commands. When that person doesn't comply mm-hmm. is where you have to make the decision to shoot or not to shoot. And so oftentimes officers have difficulty in de-escalating from that. Mm-hmm. It's just because it's not an automatic switch. There's some research that would indicate that it takes about two to two and a half seconds before you actually recognize that there's no longer a threat or that threat isn't present when you're in that moment.
Wow. Yasmin, on Twitter here, interesting point. Benny tweets, seems like Canadian officers understand that many suspects act threatening because they want to be shot. Tough job for U.S. cops, considering the lack of other services, mental health, reintegration from prison, etc. And then he adds, people with mental illness are much more likely to be victims of violence, not perpetrators. Can we stop scapegoating? So this required that Officer Lamb make this assessment of where this suspect, again, knowing that he had just killed people in his van, make this assessment about how he was going to behave in the midst of some kind of mental episode. That's an incredibly unpredictable and risky calculation in that moment for him and maybe some of his other officers, isn't it?
It's definitely an unpredictable situation. And as many people know, this situation is referred to as suicide by cop, and they do happen more frequently than you would think. In that regard, also, you could also compare Canadian and U.S. police organizations, because in Canada, there are less firearms. We have 7 million firearms in Canada, whereas in the United States, there's about 300 million. So I see police not assuming that everything and everyone will have a firearm in Canada. And that's kind of how they think, even though they do take officer safety into account, but they don't assume that everyone does have a firearm.
Micah in Long Lake called to say the officer's number one job isn't officer safety. It's their job to bring suspects to justice. Every time they kill someone, they're potentially killing an innocent person, their judge, jury, and executioner. David, I don't know if you would put it like that, but I take Micah's point. You don't know who the person you're in confrontation with, what they've done, how this would be adjudicated in the courts, which makes use of force that much more, I guess, serious and troublesome for officers.
I would agree to a point, but I would put it in the perspective of, and you said this, the officer, the person that we encounter, if you look at it from that standpoint, that individual knows everything about themselves. They know if they're wanted. They know if they've committed the crime. They know everything that they've done.
Right.
The officer is really at a disadvantage when they arrive on the scene because they have to make that assessment. And so I think, you know, if there was a magic tool or a crystal ball that we could look at and say, okay, this is what we have, it would make life much easier. But in this case, it's a crapshoot. And it also depends. I'll keep going back to this. It depends on the officer's confidence and his or her skill set level. If that is diminished, then you're more likely to see an excessive use of force. If their skill sets are good and they've kept up with them, then you will see that person be much more in control of a situation.
When you say confidence, do you mean I've got experience with this, I've been here before, I know how to handle this, or confidence in I've got this situation, I can see three steps ahead in a way that maybe the person I'm involved in this with can't?
I think it's both of those. I think the one aspect is that when you think about, are my empty hand skills good? So if I get into a scrap with somebody, I can, you know, I'm able to control them and I'm not afraid of being in that encounter. So will I be able to control them? The other thing is trying to do, if you do it a threat assessment, which is what every officer should be doing as they arrive on that scene with that individual, is they should be planning three steps ahead to see where this is going to end and how they are going to resolve that situation. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of intuition. It's a little bit of experience. And it's a little bit of keeping those perishable skills intact.
If you've just joined us this morning, David Thomas is with us from Florida Gulf Coast University and experience as a former Gainesville, Florida police officer. And Yasmeen Kremadeen is with us. She's director of research and development at Pro Training and joining us from Edmonton, Canada. If you haven't seen the video, although it went viral and a lot of news organizations broadcast it last week, it is this confrontation between a Toronto police officer and a suspect who was believed to have just killed, I think, as many as 10 people with his van. The reason it's notable is that the officer, even though the suspect is in the moment saying, I have a gun, he appears to be a pretty serious threat to the officer de-escalates. And there was a lot of assessment about how Officer Ken Lam handled that. We're asking two guests with a lot of experience in this to kind of dissect the video and then talk to us this morning about what that de-escalation actually involves and whether more American police departments are taking de-escalation seriously and whether it's changing the way that they're actually policing. David Thomas told us that as he and his wife watched the video the first time, they observed that if that had been an American situation and an American police officer, that suspect probably would have been shot. 651-227-6000 this morning. If you're in law enforcement, What do you see in that video? What do you make of our conversation about de-escalation? Have you practiced it? Have you been trained in it? What happened? And then for the rest of us, I wonder if you believe that public pressure is changing the way that police departments are using force in these difficult situations. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Bill in Roseville. Hi, Bill. What are you thinking about?
Yeah, Carrie, I was just wondering if your guests would comment about is there new research, or are the academies offering more non-lethal options for cops rather than just reaching for the gun?
Yeah,
and specifically here in Minnesota, there was a case a few weeks ago where an Anoka County sheriff was confronted with a guy with a knife, and he knocked him down with a beanbag shotgun.
Oh, that's right.
Why don't we go to more non-lethal stuff? I understand where tasers don't always work, but Jesus, if we can put a man on the moon, we can fix this.
Okay. So, Yasmin, first to this question about that I think Bill had about other non-lethal options. How is that approached in Canada?
So I cannot comment on specific weapons used and kind of other non-lethal force, but I could comment on, I guess, the de-escalation skills and the growing number of organizations that are taking training, because I'm part of pro training. We believe in, I guess, giving officers those skills to keep them safe, and we've created training based on 7 years of scientific research out of the University of Alberta, and it's based on research that has shown that we were able to decrease force by 41% of physical force and weapon force by 26%. So what I would say is organizations are catching on that training that is heavily supported by evidence is being used, is being implemented. For our pro training program, not only have we trained groups across Canada, we're slowly getting contacted by groups in the United States. Mm. So as well, what I could let you know is that there's lots of states that are making, I guess, every 2 years they need 2 hours of de-escalation training, and it's becoming mandated. I do know it's mandated in New Mexico. We have a relationship with the Wisconsin Chiefs of Police as well. We're approved in Alaska. We're approved in Hawaii. So this training is gaining some traction, and it's becoming more mandatory, not only in Canada, but in the United States.
Yeah, I want to also say that Minneapolis Police Department requires hours of de-escalation training. So, David, to Bill's other question about there are some potential other ways, right, to take somebody down. Are more police departments turning to that?
I think those ways have been around forever. The beanbags have been around forever. But every officer is not issued a shotgun with beanbags. And I think what you find is that the taser has been around forever, it seems like. And then there's the baton, and then there's pepper spray. So those are all intermediate weapons that have been around for quite some time. The issue becomes, and ultimately what happens is, if you think about an officer, how many weapons are you going to arm him with, and how much is it going to cost the organization? So if we have beanbags, does that mean that we're not going to give him an AR-style weapon in order to be able to defend himself in if something else happens? So there are trade-offs. And so that's where we're stuck, especially in this day and age when you talk about economy and the economics of the situation, and how much training are you going to mandate, and will you keep that training up?
So, David, the other question is, when you watched that video for the first time, did it also occur to you that things might have been very different even in Toronto if the suspect had been black?
That did occur to me. In fact, that was and when I talked to other people, that's one of the first things that comes up, is that if he had been black, he probably would have been shot. I can't, and it's kind of hard to say that, because I know that, or to make that inference. The only thing, because I know that we do have an issue here in this country, and so that's where we're kind of hung up on the fence. But what we don't know, and I think that the greater issue is it just race, or is it the situation that the officer is involved in? Or, let's say, is it their training or lack thereof?
Yasmin, what about that? As I looked back into some of the situations where Toronto police and other Canadian police departments have shot suspects who either didn't have a weapon or didn't seem to be, you know, absolutely threatening the officer with that weapon, many of those people that have ended up being shot were of color. This is an issue in Canada as well, isn't it?
So again, I would say that every situation is different. And in lots of these situations, police, they don't always have that time to think what they plan to do. In many situations, they react quickly. And when the reaction is quick, it is led by emotions and fear rather than training.
Brian says on Twitter, the suspect didn't reach for the gun. He said it was in his pocket. Hard to imagine the Toronto officer exercising more patience had he done that, right? Reach for it, I think Brian's saying. The way I see it, the suspect allowed it to play out how it did because he went right up to the line without crossing it. To the phones, to Blaine in Fargo. Hi, Blaine.
Yeah, good morning. Say, I just tuned in and I have not seen the video, but my comment is that we have recently had some officer-involved shootings up here that I think would have normally ended in death. But in my assumption, in one case, it was just that the person didn't end up getting hit. And in the other case, I think it was the officer that made that hair-second decision that he didn't have to kill the person, that he could wound them with the gun. The gun's a tool. It doesn't have to be just used to kill. It could be used to disarm, to maim, to do different things. And another thing that I thought of during this, too, is the public, you know, this is kind of an unknown area where people are all like, oh, they're trained to shoot to kill. And so nobody really knows what they're trained as far as, at least I don't and people I know don't. But I see the gun as valuable in a lot more ways than just killing.
Okay, so the two really good points here, Blaine. Thanks for that. So on the wounding, David, you hear a lot of this after one of these confrontations. Why doesn't the officer just shoot them in the shoulder or shoot them in the leg and disable them? Why don't officers do that?
Well, the situation is dynamic. And so from a physiological standpoint on the officer's side, he or she has to rely on their gross motor skills, meaning that a lot of the fine-tuned things that you would have normally are kind of gone. The focus, though, is the objective is to stop the threat. To ask an officer to aim at a shoulder, a leg, an arm would almost be impossible with a handgun when you think about a subject moving and that dynamic is ongoing. And so that becomes the issue. And that is actually the issue. So and I think there's some data that shows that I know there is. It shows that there's that the law enforcement usually hits their target only about 25% of the time. When they're actually involved in a shooting.
Wow.
When we look at the parts of the body to hit, you would think the upper torso is the easiest part to hit. The objective is not to kill, it's to stop the threat. Unfortunately, when you talk about hitting the upper parts of the body, that is where your organs are. And so that means that the objective is to have the person lose consciousness or be able to relinquish. And then our objective after that is to give them first aid. And that's unfortunately, that's the way it is.
So, Yasmin, I'm interested, especially since you may be doing some training here in the States. What do you tell police officers who are being trained for this about de-escalation in the presence of a weapon? It doesn't have to be a gun, but some kind of deadly weapon that the suspect is holding. How do you try to instill, you know, the principles of de-escalation then?
Definitely. So first and foremost, we also have police facilitators on board in our training sessions. So if there is a weapon present, we tell them to rely on the skills that they learn in their police organization, because every organization is different. They have different policies, they have different training, they have different rules. So we don't get into the weapons and when they're present.
Okay.
But we do get into when, I guess, individuals are unresponsive, kind of to vary your speech, to ask different questions,
and
individuals are uncooperative.
If I may, when you say unresponsive, you mean not listening to the commands of the police officer?
Not listening, or even not talking back to the officer, not responding.
But what if that person who's not responding has some kind of, you know, weapon that the officer would view as a threat? How do you teach de-escalation in that situation?
again, in that situation, they'd have to rely on their training from their own organizations and how their organizations teach when they encounter a weapon.
David, what would you say to that?
I would say that there's a couple of things. One is that we train officers to give loud verbal commands. We want everybody to be aware around us, plus the person that we are encountering, to give them the loud verbal commands so they recognize there's an issue. What we have never taught, and what I realized in the last couple of years, is we've never taught officers to tone those down, to back off a little bit and try to have a conversation. Because when an officer has a tactical advantage, i.e. I have a gun pointed at somebody and I'm yelling, well, the barrel of that gun looks huge.
Right.
And so if we can have that conversation at a much lower tone, it takes away the fear, and you probably can get into the person's head and say, okay, this is kind of where we are. And so that is – and I've talked to trainers, and I continue to have friends that are still training, and he says, no, we don't do that. And so I asked, why not? I said, because if we do that, what happens is what you'll see is that the officer will de-escalate. Doesn't mean that he or she doesn't have the tactical advantage, but it kind of gives them an opportunity to look at options other than deadly force if they can.
By the way, the National Alliance of Mental Illness Minnesota is reminding me now that Minnesota requires de-escalation. So I mentioned that Minneapolis's police department, but now this is training that occurs throughout Minnesota. Not sure how much of it, depending on each individual police force. Yasmin Kremadine with us from Director of Research and Development at Pro Training, where they are training police officers in Canada and perhaps some police departments in the States on de-escalation. And David Thomas with us with experience as a former police officer and now an associate professor of forensic psychology at Florida Gulf Coast University. Right back to the calls to Yasin in Edina. Hey, and thank you so much for waiting. I really appreciate it. Tell me what you're thinking about.
Hi, thanks for having me. Just thinking about what you said, you know, is training coming? Are they doing things to de-escalate? Are they teaching the officers things, you know, tactics to de-escalate instead of you know, use lethal force?
Right.
And I think about what happened with the Waffle House, the black woman in the Waffle House a couple weeks ago, where they basically put her in a chokehold. I think they put their feet on her neck and they exposed her breast and basically used very, you know, lethal. It was a very small incident as well. It was a dispute about forks or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about what happened at the Starbucks. That could have been, you know, that could have escalated to a more lethal situation as well. Like if there weren't cameras around, if there weren't witnesses around, it could have been deadly for those two black guys.
Right.
So the
guys that were in the Starbucks shop where the manager called the police because they hadn't bought anything yet and she wanted them to leave the Starbucks, yes?
Yeah, so that could have been, you know, deadly for those two guys. If there weren't those, you know, people like filming there, if there weren't, you know, white bystanders, you know, basically trying to be an ally for them, which they were. So I just feel like whatever training that they're doing, whatever, you know, internal changes they're making, they're not coming fast enough, especially for communities of color.
Yeah, this is a really good point, David. I guess how the police department and police officers enter a situation that you know isn't even going to be some kind of deadly force situation. Are we seeing enough changes in that way too?
I don't think so. From a practical perspective, there's a disconnect between the way you treat the way you see officers treat people and the way they should be treated. I used to teach officers and try to tell them that on every call that what I wanted from them was to treat people like it was their mom or their dad, unless they gave them a reason not to.
Hmm.
But the other part of that is a lot of officers, and some of the research that I've done, is a lot of officers don't believe they're actually scared, or the only way they believe that they have control is when they are forceful with their voice and putting hands on rather than just trying to have a regular conversation. And so that is something that needs to be addressed as far as the training goes, because they always have the upper hand theoretically. And so with that in mind, then there's no reason to act any other way.
You know, if, Yasmeen, I want to talk, ask you about fear, because this has come up in a number of calls and tweets, and David just referenced that as well. How do officers get trained to manage that anxiety of going into an unpredictable situation, and then, you know, how that fear kind of drives their behavior and the interaction?
So in terms of training for fear, I would say there are a few programs available that they bring in the deep breathing techniques so that an officer doesn't have a panic attack while they are engaging. So the research, I'm not fully, I guess, informed about in terms of which training offers this fear type training. But I do know that police organizations are realizing that this is a thing and we need to prepare officers to, I guess, handle their own fear.
Call here from Connie in central Minnesota. Hi, Connie.
Hi.
Your husband is an officer?
He is.
So how are you thinking about this discussion?
I think that it's a really important discussion to have. I think that the de-escalation training needs to happen. My husband would agree with that. It's a very important thing to have a different focus than perhaps what was done in the past with the training.
Mm-hmm.
The concern that I have is that all of the discussion seems to be leaning towards non-lethal force, which of course is important. But I heard a caller earlier mention, what about, you know, use of firearms for maiming or injuring?
Right.
And that brought up a memory of mine from my husband has been fortunate only to have drawn his weapon, I think, twice in his career.
Mm-hmm.
And one time in particular was very jarring for him. These are emotional situations for everybody involved.
Of course.
And people don't seem to attempt to see it from the officer's position as often as the other individual involved. And when he drew his weapon at one time, it was because somebody had a knife. Now, our area is a long ways off from diverse, but it was a gentleman of color.
Mm-hmm.
And that never even crossed his mind as being a factor in the situation. But what people don't seem to understand is the reason he had to draw his gun was because, I might get the numbers wrong here, but if he doesn't make the choice to pull that trigger within about 15 feet, he has the odds of losing his own life and not making it home to me that night. And I think that's something for people to really keep in perspective when they're considering what these other options are,
right,
that they need to be used smartly. You know, they need to be used intelligently. They need to be used with great caution. But to consider the idea of, you know, I understand having a knife available doesn't seem like it would be necessary to have a gun drawn on them by a police officer, but it may indeed be the case.
Now, you bring up two really good things here, Connie. David, I hear Connie saying we don't necessarily appreciate the peril that these officers are indeed in and their perception of the peril that they're in.
Right. And that perception is unique to each individual officer. Deadly force and the use of force is a very personal thing. Again, it's confidence and it's the skill set. She mentioned about the 15 feet. Actually, it's 21 feet.
Okay.
The drill is called a Tooler drill. And what we do is we use that to show officers and trainees how quickly a person who was armed with a knife, a baseball bat, or with any kind of weapon in their hand, how quickly they can close that distance. And it's usually less than 3 seconds. So even as old as I am, at 62 years old, I can make that distance and cover that distance pretty quick. And so officers are trained, you know, they have to be so aware of their surroundings. And so that weapon is a tool for the officer. The firearm's a tool, and it gets officers out of many scrapes as more so than it does get them in using deadly force.
The other thing that I don't want to miss is what Connie said about the time that her husband had to pull his gun, that the person that he was in this confrontation with was of color, with the knife, and she said, my husband, that had no bearing in it. And I'm not here to say that police officers are consciously treating people of color in a different way. But I think one of the things we've learned here is that people of color end up being treated differently in these use of force situations, subconsciously, because the fear level is heightened and for a number of other reasons. And I hope you'll say something about that.
Well, I think that's a reality. I mean, but you also have to look at there's so many variables that go into this when we talk about race and we talk about color and we talk about officer decision making. If you think about a city and you look at how maybe the city is divided in the neighborhoods, look at where most of the violence occurs, what group of people that they're involved with, and it's usually poor and the disenfranchised, be they black or white. That is where that happens. And so when those officers are constantly and consistently dealing with that group, and I don't mean it in a negative connotation whatsoever, but that becomes, that heightens your awareness and it heightens your sensitivity and it heightens your, you know, you feel that there is, that you have to react. But what, again, I'll go back and say this, is what officers and what we have not done well with officers is train them to return to some sort of homeostasis where they are back to where things are normal through deep breathing or through being able to reflect on that day and be able to put it aside so that when you go to work the next day, you start with a clean slate. Mm-hmm. Because there's baggage that's associated with everything that you do in this job.
Call here from Kim in Prior Lake. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted, I'm a social worker. I did work in mental health. I did have a former client that was killed by Minneapolis police because they did not use de-escalation techniques. Hmm. And I am just, you know, one of the primary things that we learn as social workers is how to de-escalate situations. That's a primary focus of our training. And I would like to see that not just ancillary or, you know, updated training that individual police departments do, but it should be part of the training. It should be a huge part of the training that people that are going into law enforcement get, you know, along with the, that, you know, 15 seconds and they can get, you know, the threat risk of 15 seconds and they do that kind of training that your panelist was talking about. They should also be getting the same amount of training in de-escalation. Mm. Okay. And I don't think that's happening anywhere.
Yasmin, what did you tell me about the Canadian requirement on de-escalation? Did you say it was a couple hours or more?
There's currently no specific requirement, but there are groups across Canada that are mandating training in their own organizations.
Okay. But and do you have a – does Pro Training have an opinion on how many hours are – necessary to really absorb the training and utilize it?
I believe that training needs to be refreshed. I would say that we lose the skills of de-escalation after 1 year of training. So it's good to constantly refresh those skills. But not only to refresh them, it's good to refresh them while also doing use of force training. So I believe that de-escalation training needs to happen at the same time and with use of force training. So we kind of need to change the name and to kind of make it, I guess, available so that we can include both of them together so that it's not just you're going into use of force training, therefore you're just using force, or you're just going into de-escalation training and you just have to use de-escalation, because then officers go in kind of knowing what the facilitators are looking for. So it has to be included together. And I would say that police organizations are, I guess, getting hold of this news. They know that more training is better. Police across the, I guess, Canada and the United States have been taking our training. We offer a 90-minute online training program. Sorry, it's 90 minutes to 2 hours. Usually it's around the two-hour mark, mm-hmm. Just depending on how long officers take to take the training. So you would just simply go to protraining.com. You would click login, register, you'd purchase a $50 course, and then you'd be able to take that training instantly and get certified.
Yasmin, I really appreciate the time and the insight. Thanks for being part of the conversation.
Thank you.
Yasmin Kremadine from Pro Training. Ricardo says the challenge with the shootings have less to do with equipment. It has to do with a predisposition to fear. These are reactions, and they're afraid of what they don't know. To Jamal in Lakeville. Hi, Jamal. What's your sense of how the conversation's gone so far?
I mean, I do appreciate for taking my call, and I do appreciate all the experts that are pulling in One thing that I do want to add to the conversation is the community relation policing is not there most of the time, especially the big cities, mm-hmm. where the police don't even know who they're dealing with, and they don't probably have no time to get involved with the community. I do live in Lakefield. I live in Eagan, Burnsville. I live all these cities. I do feel the police on these cities are friendly because I know them. I rarely deal with them, but I do see them even dealing with people most of the time. They get close to them. They talk to them. There's rarely no, like, violence or anything. So I do think if the policing, especially in big cities like Minneapolis, do add, they need to add more time to know the community that they're policing. So that fear is not there anymore. Yeah. If that can happen, I believe a lot of things can happen.
This really, David, makes a lot of sense what Jamal is saying. That said, I'm sympathetic to, if you're working in a big city police department, it just may not be possible to know everybody that you're going to encounter on a given day.
I would agree with that, but I would also offer that it doesn't necessarily, it's an art that is lost even in small cities. I just finished doing a training series for a local agency here, and interesting with that is that we did a thing on, I've been a part of this agency for the last 9 years, mm-hmm. and the new chief wanted to make changes, and he tried to get them involved in the community, and the officers they rebelled.
Really?
So now we're 10 years down the road, 9 or 10 years down the road, and they have a gang problem, and it just sprung up overnight. But you know well that that gang problem did not spring up overnight. It was over time, and they should have addressed it. So they've had six shootings in the last 4 months, and they hadn't had a homicide in over 12 years.
This is in Gainesville?
It's just north of Gainesville. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. And the officers in the training, I asked them, name three things that your agency experiences, that you need to be addressed. The three things were personnel, equipment, and a new report writing system. They know they have a gang problem. They've been working the shootings, and not one group mentioned the gang problem.
Hmm. So what would be the officer's issue with going more to, I think you said, what community-based kind of policing, which I thought most departments were doing?
Community policing is defined by an agency, and it means whatever that agency chooses to define it as. Uh-huh. The reality is that officers or chiefs and supervisors, literally supervisors, have to make their guys get out of the car and go talk to people. And so what we've decided to do this summer for one agency and another agency is to start with a summer basketball program. We think that will probably be the way to break the ice and mm-hmm. at least get the officers back into the community and get people to know them. And then I think they can build the relationships from that. So we'll do 3-on-3 basketball for the summer.
I'm interested in what you think about body cams, David, because I think in some of our previous conversations, we've discussed the pros and cons. A lot of departments went to these body cams. We still find, even here in the Twin Cities and some of the other departments, that the officers are turning them off at important moments. But overall, what's your sense of how valuable they are?
I think body cams are an excellent idea. But as we've talked about this before, is that the public needs to understand their limitations.
Okay.
And so that if an officer is involved in a shooting, that if I bring my arms up to engage with my firearm, you may not see. Mm. But the other part of that is that the policy has to dictate when the camera is turned off, when the microphone is turned off, so that it's clear and that everybody is aware, even the public, that this is why we're doing what we're doing. So it's upfront, it's open so that the public is aware of why they're doing certain things and they're not intentionally trying to hide stuff.
Okay. Cheryl says on Twitter, when my badge was pinned on my uniform years ago, I took a pledge to protect and serve. I think a lot of officers tend to forget that oath. And to the phones to Vic in Delano. Vic, you spent some years as a police officer?
Yes, I did. And retired from the business a couple of decades ago, but I don't think that the fundamental practices of a police officer have changed all that much. Mm-hmm. But I'm concerned that people don't understand the terrible emotional swings that a police officer has to confront and experience in the day-to-day work. Mm-hmm. Number one, I just as an example, and this is obviously an exaggerated example, but happened to me that I went and was called to a horrible automobile accident shortly after coming on shift at 7 in the morning, and where five or six young children were either killed or severely damaged.
Sounds
and,
terrible.
And then I'm there for probably a half hour and cleared my responsibilities at the scene. And then my next call is a barking dog at somebody's house.
Yeah.
Both of those have to, that barking dog is very important to that person that went to the trouble of calling. And you're kind of expected to respond with an appropriate degree of politeness and kindness and that.
But you're still that terrible experience of seeing young children killed or severely injured is obviously influencing, I don't know, the rest of your day and for long afterwards, I'm sure. I think this is a really.
And the fault here was a drunken driver.
Wow.
And, you know, those are just not easy things to say, oh, I have to rely on my training here at this circumstance. You can be extremely well trained, but it's very hard to train emotional responses to circumstances that may or may not require it. But
David, this is excellent observation here from Vic. And I think those of us not in law enforcement don't understand this as well, but he's put this well. What do you say to officers about, you know, the peaks and valleys and the emotions of the day?
Well, he's correct. It is an emotional roller coaster. What I train officers to do and what I've started to do is train them to kind of do their own self-assessment or reflection for at the end of the day. And so, like I said earlier, they can clear the garbage out so they're ready to go. But I think you also need to take that time when you clear before you clear that call is maybe to go find some place, especially if it's been very difficult, and sit down and kind of process it so that you can clear your brain and move on to the next thing. But you have to take that moment to self-reflect and just not jump from call to call, because if you don't, it is just going to keep building and building and building and building. And then at some point, your coping mechanisms are going to fail.
David, it is really always valuable to have your time and your experience and your insight. I'm really grateful for it when you can do the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Thomas is an associate professor of forensic psychology at Florida Gulf Coast University and a former Gainesville police officer. And you hear now training other police officers. By the way, I had a number of tweets and calls about mindfulness training being valuable for police officers. Elizabeth called to say there are police departments where they've done mindfulness meditation. It reduces bias and lethal force incidents. If you missed much of the show or you caught just the end of it, you can find it on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller and then listen when you have time to listen.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.